I am the taste of water.
I am the taste of water.
The light of the sun and the moon.
The light of the sun and the moon.
The syllable Om in the Vedic mantras.
The syllable Om in the Vedic mantras.
I am the sound in ether and ability in man.
I am the sound, ether, and ability in man.
Okay, so if we could all mute at this time.
So, purport by Srila Prabhupada, this verse explains how the Lord is all-pervasive by his diverse material and spiritual energy. The Supreme Lord can be preliminarily perceived by his different energies. And in this way, he is realized impersonally. As the demigod in the sun is a person and is perceived by his all-pervading energy, the sunshine, so the Lord, although in his eternal abode, is perceived by his all-pervading diffusive energies. The taste of water is the active principle of water. No one likes to drink seawater because the pure taste of water is mixed with salt. Attraction for water depends on the purity of the taste, and this pure taste is one of the energies of the Lord. The impersonalist perceives the presence of the Lord in water by its taste, and the personalist also glorifies the Lord for his kindly supplying tasty water to quench man's thirst. That is the way of perceiving the Supreme. Practically speaking, there is no conflict between personalism and impersonalism. One who knows God knows that the impersonal conception and personal conception are simultaneously present in everything, and that there is no contradiction. Therefore, Lord Chaitanya established his sublime doctrine, Achintya Bheda Bhedya Tattva, simultaneous oneness and difference. The light of the sun and the moon is also originally emanating from the Brahmajyoti, which is the impersonal effulgence of the Lord. And pranava, or the Omkara, transcendental sound in the beginning of every Vedic hymn, addresses the Supreme Lord. Because the impersonalists are very much afraid of addressing the Supreme Lord Krishna by his innumerable names, they prefer to vibrate the transcendental sound Omkara. But they do not realize that Omkara is the sound representation of Krishna. The jurisdiction of Krishna consciousness extends everywhere, and one who knows Krishna consciousness is blessed. Those who do not know Krishna are in illusion, and so knowledge of Krishna is liberation, and ignorance of him is bondage. Om Agyanti Nirangasya Gyananjana Shalakaya Chakshu Nilitam Yena Tashmai Shri Gurave Namaha Sri Chaitanya Manobhistam Stapitam Yena Bhutale Swaya Rupa Kadami Yam Dadati Swa Padante Kam Ancha Kalpa Tarubhyascha Kripa Sindhubaya Evacha Patita Nam Pavanebhyo Vaishnabhyo Namo Namaha Jai Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Sri Advaita Gadadhara Srivas Adi Gaura Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare. Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare. Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare. Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Lasoham apsu kaunteya prabhasmi sasi suryayo pranava sarva vedeshu sabdake purusham nishu. O son of Kunti, I am the taste of water, the light of the sun and moon. The syllable Om in the Vedic mantras. I am the sound in ether and ability in man. So, last week we saw how Krishna, in the verses starting at verse 4, began to describe some of his energies to Arjuna. And he said that he's earth, water, fire, air, ether, mind, intelligence, and false ego are the constituents of his material energy, and that he had Besides this, he has a superior energy which comprises the living entities. So Krishna explains that the living entities are exploiting the resources of the inferior material nature. So just like we have our bodies, right? We are the superior energy, but we are exploiting everything around us, starting with our own bodies. We use the senses, taste, sight, smell, touch, and the last one. We use them to exploit nature and matter around us. This is what we are doing all the time. And in that way, we are trying to be happy that way by enjoying this inferior energy. The Krishna is actually saying that we are superior energy, actually. And the frustration that we feel in life is because we are not actually understanding that we are superior energy, superior to this inferior energy, and we are identifying with the inferior energy, including the mind and the intelligence. We are using this inferior energy to try to realize ourselves in terms of our happiness. And this is not ultimately in our interest. Krishna talks about, or in the earlier purpose, Srila Prabhupada explains that since Krishna is the possessor of the energies are actually meant for Krishna. He is the one who has caused the energies to manifest. And he is the controller of the energies, and ultimately he is the enjoyer of the energies. But the living entity, you know, is falsely considering himself to be the enjoyer, the Purusha. And by falsely trying to enjoy the energy, he actually, through sense gratification, separately from Krishna, he's actually feeding into his lust and all sorts of insatiable desires that come from trying to exploit the energy, because it's endless. You can never find satisfaction, so he's always trying harder and harder and harder, chewing the chute. He's struggling very hard to squeeze enjoyment out of the material energy. And the material energy is frustrating him all along, all the way, because he's just not, that is not his nature. His real nature is spirit. And so it's impossible. It's impossible to get satisfaction from matter. It's just not possible. No matter how hard anyone may try, ultimately it all ends in defeat, right? Like we had in the class this morning, how the Bhuttos amassed so much wealth, but Benazir Bhutto died at the end of it, so she didn't even enjoy the wealth. So that is the nature of the material energy. If we go on exploiting it, it's not possible to enjoy it. So Krishna is actually the proprietor of the energy. He's the cause, and he's the enjoyer. And that enjoying mentality, which is separate from Krishna, Krishna describes it as a demoniac mentality, right? He describes it as a demoniac mentality. And he says in that chapter where he describes the demoniac mentality that it is not, you cannot attain the supreme destination through such a mentality, nor can you be happy even in this world. It's not possible. So Krishna also says that he's the origin and the dissolution of the material energy, right? He says that he's the origin and the dissolution. He's the beginning and the end of the material energy. So therefore, of course, by definition, he's also the middle. If something is at the beginning and it's at the end, he must be in the middle as well. So he's in the middle as the maintainer. And he says that, Mata Parataram Nanyat Kinchit Astita Nanjaya Mai Sevam Idam Pratam Sutri Manigana Iva. So that was the last verse we looked at last week, where Krishna is saying that he's like a thread on which pearls are strung. And he is, that thread represents him, because when pearls are on a thread, right? When pearls are on a thread, the pearls are held together by the thread. If the thread breaks, we can see what chaos ensues. The pearls are scattered everywhere, but the thread is holding the pearls together. So the thread puts order into the pearls. And also, like our Kunti Mala, right? If it's nicely strung, you shouldn't see the thread, right? If it's done properly. So the thread on the pearls is also like that. You don't see the thread, but the thread is certainly there, but it's not seen. So Krishna is pervading this whole creation, right? He's pervading this whole, and he's supporting everything like that thread that we cannot see. So the materialist cannot see Krishna, so therefore he thinks that Krishna is not there. But that is Krishna's mystic potency. He's absolutely everywhere, and he's causing everything to be and to exist, but he is not seen. So he gives examples in the Bhagavad Gita how he's, by his potency, he enters into the planets and he causes them to float. So these planets are floating. We can't see anybody holding them. But when we were kids, we saw that image of Atlas holding the earth. And Krishna is not like that. We don't see him holding it like that. He's entered the planets, and by his potency, they are floating, right? And he's like the fire of digestion in the stomach. He says, he's the fire of digestion. He's digesting food. We eat food somehow or other by some, you know, achintya, some inconceivable potency. Everything is digested very amazingly. Everything is extracted or assimilated, you know, and all the nutrients go into the body, the blood, everything is just amazing. And all that is being done by Krishna. We didn't do any of this. We didn't create our bodies, you know. Nobody sat there to design their body. But everything is working so amazingly. The heart is beating all the time. So Krishna is the person who is doing all these things. So he's that unseen person in us. And if you just think about how everything is running very nicely, I mean, the universe, right, the scientists tell us that, yes, it's all working very nicely, very precisely, very precisely. So precise is incredible. I mean, they know exactly when the sun is going to rise, to the second, when the sun is going to rise, right? Because this is our solar system, so we can make so many calculations just around us here. And everything is working very precise. All the planets are in very, very precise orbits and all that. And the scientists explain it away very simply and say it's the force of gravity, you know, gravity, the gravitational attraction between the different planets and the different masses of the planets causes everything to just work very nicely. Yes, that may be true. It all sounds very simple. But that doesn't take away the mystery of how it's all happening like that. It's just these gigantic planets, you know, rotating and revolving around others at immense speeds. You know, it's just a mystery. So to just say it's gravity is one thing, but actually to really understand it, you understand that it's somebody who must be doing it. And Krishna is saying that he's the person who is doing all these things. He's not seen. He's just not seen, but he's certainly the one who is doing all these things. So Newton was a great scientist, but he was also a very humble personality. He was a very humble personality, you know. So and God-fearing as well. God-fearing, but he's a devotee, you know. So we shouldn't fear God, actually, because we should love God, not fear him, because Krishna loves us, he's our father. But it's a term used, God-fearing. So Newton, he made a model once of the solar system, right, and in his house. It was a working model, right? He did some very precise calculations, and he created a model. And on the model, there was the sun in the middle and the planets were going around it like that. Just a simple model, but it worked. So one time a friend of his came to his house who was an atheist, and he saw the model, and he said to Newton, "Gosh, Newton, this is quite amazing. You know, this is quite amazing, all these planets you've done like this, you know, all these going in different orbits, and it all looks very amazing. How did you do this?" So Newton said in a very matter-of-fact way, he said, "Oh, one morning I woke up and it was all there." So his friend says, "Oh, come on, don't be silly. What do you mean, it was all there?" So Newton said to him, "Well, this is exactly what you are doing. You're telling me to believe about the universe, which is unlimited and amazing and just extraordinary. You're asking me to just believe that it just happened by itself." So in the same way that... I'm telling you, this is there. You are telling me to believe everything, and it's just not, it doesn't make any sense, does it? So his friend actually began to rethink his position. So Newton was very humble because he said that when he goes onto the seashore, right, his knowledge is like a person on the seashore, a person who goes onto the seashore, and he just picks up some few pebbles, right? So a child may go onto the seashore and pick up some one or two interesting pebbles, but on the seashore, there are unlimited pebbles, right? So he said that his knowledge was like that. His knowledge was like just finding one or two small things. You know, there are unlimited mysteries out there. And if we compare that attitude to the to the attitude of the modern scientists who think they know everything, you know. They know everything. So, of course, Krishna tells us that knowledge breeds humility, real knowledge. If a person is really knowledge, naturally they become humble. You see, that is why in the 13th chapter, the process of knowledge starts with humility. Real knowledge actually endows one with humility. It's a natural byproduct of knowledge. So that is how he was very, very humble, because he actually had knowledge and he knew that there was an immense power. And the same thing with Einstein also. He also knew that there was an immense power behind everything that we were seeing. And it wasn't just just reductionist thinking. There was actually, at the end of the day, there was something really great there. So in today's verse, Krishna is saying that he is the taste of water. Krishna is beginning to tell us how he's the essence of everything. He's actually the essence, right? He saw that he's the energies. These things are his energy, water and earth and all that. That is energy. Now he's telling us that he's actually also the active principle in all of these manifestations. So he starts with the Pancha Mahabhuta, the earth, water, fire, air and all that. He starts to talk about those things. In this verse, he's talking about water, right? He says, I'm the taste of water. I'm the light of the sun and the moon. The syllable Om in the Vedic mantra. In the next verse, he talks about that he is the fragrance of the earth, right? Like that. So he talks about these things, and he's actually showing us how he's actually the essence of each of these things. So Hinduism, right? Hinduism, actually, we know that Hinduism is not one particular religion. It's the generic. It's made of different religions, right? But they have something in common in that they believe in the authority. They accept the authority of the Vedas, and also they believe in the law of reincarnation and karma, like that. So Hinduism, right, when it's practiced properly, is also a very, very wonderful religion, because it's actually been described as it's been coined as the environmentally friendly religion, because Hinduism actually understands that everything originates from a divine source. Everything originates from a divine source. And that divine source makes everything that we see divine, because it's come from a divine source. And that divine source has got its energy inside everything. Every manifestation has got a spark of the divine in it, because it's coming from that source. And so therefore, everything is treated with respect if that religion is practiced properly, which already originally we know is a Vedic culture. Everything is treated absolutely with respect because it is seen as divine, right? So because everything is seen as divine, there is the sacredness that pervades the whole of creation. And that sacredness and gratitude to creation is recognized, because once we understand that everything is divine, naturally we have natural respect, so that, like, they greet each other, and in India they say namaste and all that, because they see the divine in somebody, right? Not that the person is God or anything, but it's just recognizing the divine presence in everyone, in all animals. And that vision is so powerful that everything, you know, animate and inanimate, you know, is seen as spiritual. And so therefore there's mountains, lakes, trees, all these manifestations, rivers, lakes, yes, they are all seen as divine. And they are respected and worshipped like that, animals. So this is actually the value of understanding the divine nature. Because if you understand the divine nature, naturally the byproduct of that will be respect for that divine nature, rather than trying to exploit. There's a peaceful coexistence, because I see myself as part of that nature and I see other things around me as part of that nature. And in that sense, there's some kind of oneness, right? There's some kind of oneness, because we all understand that we are all coming from the same source. Of course, Krishna tells us that he's the father of all the living entities, right? He's the father, the seed-giving father of all the living entities. And he's also all the manifestations. So this attitude, right, this attitude of seeing everything as sacred is very, very necessary for spiritual life. To understand real spiritual culture really requires that, because that is also the vision of the Mahabhagavat. The Mahabhagavat sees everything, Krishna's presence in everything and everywhere, right? He sees everything in Krishna, and he sees everything as Krishna's presence. So that is actually a vision that is very necessary for everybody ultimately to have that understanding. Now, if we contrast this with Western ideas, right? We can see that the Western philosophy has always treated man and nature as separate entities. They are not seen as the same of the same nature. They're seen as completely separate, and they believe that the man has the prerogative to exploit nature. This is how it's always been. That man, nature has to be exploited. Man is separate from nature. And nature, including the animals, the minerals, everything is there to be exploited by man. And we can see that not only in Western philosophy, but also the religion, like the religions of Christianity and Islam, you know, teach that God has given us dominion over all these things, right, over all the manifestations, animals, everything. And that mentality, you know, if it's held like that, or if that is the mentality of somebody, the person actually naturally sees everything as there for his enjoyment, right? And that's how people cannot understand, because that is the understanding that everything is here for our enjoyment. So they find it very difficult to see when you try to explain to them that, no, this is not actually what it is. We are all meant to be for God's enjoyment. We are all meant to cooperate for God's enjoyment, right? Not to exploit each other. So the Western thinkers, like, I got some quotes from two of them, Thomas Carlyle, in a book called The Sign of the Times. He said that, I'm quoting here, he said, we war with rude nature, and by our restless engines come off victorious and loaded with spoils. You see, that's exploitation. And Francis Bacon, he's another one. He said that nature is to be bound into service and made a slave and put in constraint. So he's saying that nature is to be enjoyed and certainly not to be revered. You know, nature is to be enjoyed. And so this is how Westerners have perceived the world all along. And it continues like that, right? It continues like that to this day. And because of that attitude, because of seeing everything, because of that very exploitative mentality, this is where, and trying to extract all the time, this is why we have actually ended up with, you know, an unsustainable way of life that we are all seeing now. The product of that greed is an unsustainable way of life where we are constantly exploiting and everything is depleting, which we're all beginning to see now, and all the environmental crisis. So Radhanath Maharaj at the Mana on Monday, he said that, you know, the degradation that we're seeing everywhere, right, the degradation that we're seeing everywhere is because it's an external manifestation of the condition of the human heart at the moment, right? This is what is causing it. The lust, greed, anger, all that in the heart, this is what is actually externally being manifested as all the degradation that we are seeing around us. So Krishna is saying that he's a taste of water, right? So water is actually very sacred, right? Water is very sacred. In many cultures, water has been seen to be very sacred. It's for cleansing, it's for purifying. And the Brahmanas use it, you know, it's offered when they bathe in rivers and all that. And in churches, they use holy water and there's baptism. So water has got lots of spiritual significance. Right? Krishna is here, he's emphasizing that he's the taste. Yes, he's emphasizing that he's the taste because he wants us to actually perceive that taste and understand that it's him. But water itself is sacred in that sense also, that it has sacred uses apart from just its taste. And in baptism also, you know, people immerse people in water like that. And that tradition of baptism actually, and in Christian times, they trace it back to Jewish times also, the Old Testament times, when the Jews also used some kind of baptism to initiate, some dipping in water to initiate converts to Judaism. Right? So we know that beyond that, you go beyond that religion of Judaism, you have Vedic culture. So these things have got their origins in Vedic culture, right? These things have got their origins in Vedic culture, where sacred rivers, people bathe in holy rivers, and God purified in that way. So water is also seen as a regenerator, like it regenerates vegetation, right? When there's water coming down, everything becomes revived. So because of these qualities of water, it is seen as able to regenerate the spirit. Both the body and the spirit are cleansed and regenerated by water. And Krishna is saying that he's the taste. So Prabhupada, of course, says that, Krishna is very amazing because whenever we drink water, we can remember Krishna. So this is actually the idea of what Krishna is telling us. We should, when we drink water, we have to remember that this is the taste of water is Krishna, and the purity of that water, actually, the purity of that water is Krishna. And that is how he wants us to remember him. Krishna also says that he's the light of the sun and the moon, right? So we know that the sun is also worshipped by people, right? The sun is also worshipped as people, as given, as health given. I don't chant Gayatri, but people when they're chanting Gayatri, maybe not devotees, but other people when they're chanting Gayatri, they chant it to the sun, right? But I believe devotees, when they're chanting Gayatri, they are seeing the effulgence of Krishna's lotus feet and meditating on the effulgence of Krishna's lotus feet, which is as effulgent as the sun, right? So by connecting with the sun that way, we remember Krishna. So Krishna is saying that he is the light of the sun. He's the light of the sun and the moon. And the sun does that. The sun also is giving life. The sun is giving life to everything, and the sun is worshipped, right? The sun is worshipped because it gives life to everything. And so Prabhupada says that the sky is blue, right? The sky is blue because Krishna is blue. That is why the sky is also blue. It's quite interesting. And Krishna says here, he says, I am the syllable Om in the Vedic mantras. So the syllable Om, now we know that Om is the impersonal, Om is the impersonal aspect of Krishna, right? Om is the impersonal aspect of Krishna. So and when that name Om is chanted, actually it's referring to Krishna, because all the Vedic prayers start with Om. And Krishna is to be known by all the Vedas. And all the Vedas are meant, actually, for us to know Krishna. And so when we chant that Om, we are also referring to Krishna and his impersonal aspect. And Om, the vibration Om is used throughout Vedic prayers, right, to address Krishna. And Krishna is that Om. He's that Om that is used in all the prayers. Om Agyanti Nirandasya Yananjana Shalakaya Chakshu Umilitamina Tashmai Sigurave Namah. That's Om. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti. Like that. And Om is used to address Krishna. Krishna says that he is the sound in ether and ability in man. So sound, we know that everything has come from sound originally, right? It's from sound that everything manifests. The ether, the sound is the subtle form of the ether. And everything comes from the ether. From the ether comes air. From air comes fire. From fire comes water. And from water comes the earth. So sound, like when we clap, is the evidence of the ether, because the sound, something has to carry the sound, right? Something has to carry the sound. And clapping, the noise of the clapping is transferred by that ether. So Krishna is saying that he is actually the sound in the ether, which is the basic principle of the ether, is the sound. The sound is actually the evidence of the ether. And there's so many sounds in the ether, right? There's so many sounds in the ether, spiritual sound and material sound. Right, so we came here through sound, and Sepapa says that we are going to come out of here through sound as well. And the sound that we're going to come out of, obviously, is a sound vibration, is a spiritual sound vibration, which is going to take us out of this material world, which is the chanting of Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hari Rama, Hari Rama, Rama Rama Hari Hari. So sound is the basic principle of the ether. And Krishna is saying that he is sound, right? He is sound in the ether. And he says that he is the ability in man. Now, the ability in man, normally this is seen as, we normally like translate it as anyone's ability. Anything that someone is doing, we should understand that that is Krishna. That is one understanding. But I've also heard that this reference here to ability in man is referring more to the determination to succeed in spiritual life. That determination to succeed in spiritual life, that is the essence of the ability, is the determination to succeed in spiritual life rather than just ability. Because ability can also be seen as intelligence, you know, some type of intelligence, which Krishna has already said that he's intelligent, or he's going to say that he's intelligent. So ability is the determination to succeed in spiritual life. But if it's seen as also just ability, it can also be understood like that, which is how we understand it here. So that ability, Krishna is saying that whenever you see ability in anybody, you should understand that it's me. You know, I am that ability in that person. So we should not, as much as we should admire and give credit for anyone's abilities, we have to understand, use that opportunity to remember Krishna. Because this is the essence of what he's telling us in this particular verse. It's about remembering him all the time and seeing him, how we can actually see him. Because remember, he told Arjuna that we should remember him all the time. You know, we should think about him all the time. And he's given us some clues here, helping us to try to bring this about. So we're seeing constant ability everywhere. You know, somebody may be good at something, somebody may be good at something else, and it's constant ability. And just imagine if you're actually able to understand, you know, that Krishna is actually ability in person. So I'm saying that we don't necessarily, we admire ability, but we don't dwell on anyone's ability and think that it's they who are doing it. We should see it as a manifestation of Krishna, just like he's saying that beauty is his manifestation as well. Something, anything that is beautiful is because Krishna is beautiful and he's expressing his beauty in that particular thing. So Krishna is expressing his ability in anything. So that ability is given by Krishna, right? But the difference here is that Krishna has given us the ability, right? But he's not necessarily given us the intelligence to use that ability for him. We may use that ability, may exploit that ability to use it for ourselves in so many other ways and separate from Krishna, right? Just for our own enjoyment. And what we have, our choice is how to use that ability. Our choice is how to use that ability. So if we use that ability for him, then that is the proper use of the ability. That is the proper service, because he's actually meant to be the enjoyer of everything, the senses and ability, everything. He's meant to enjoy them, not us. And if we use it for ourselves, then there's degradation. So like Arjuna had the skills of a kshatriya, right? Krishna says that you should use these things. You should use this for me. He advised Arjuna to use those skills for his sake. You should become his instrument. So he's looking for our. So the ability is not what is essential, because the ability is Krishna. Everyone has got some sort of ability, but that is Krishna. That is not the main thing. The main thing that Krishna is looking for is how we are going to, whether we're going to be available to use that ability for him, whether we're going to be available as instruments. So he's looking for our availability rather than our ability. He's not too much concerned about ability, because it's him already, and that is how we should understand it. So one thing that Radhanath Maharaj also said was that he says that the Yamuna is being polluted so much these days. There's all sorts of effluents, all sorts of things going into the river, and there's one devotee who is doing a big campaign to help to clean up the river, because we've been to India, we've seen how everything is losing its spiritual significance very, very fast. And of course, it's Kali Yuga, and that is what is expected and predicted. But some people are making some sterling efforts to try to at least slow down this degradation. And there's a devotee who is doing things like that there at the moment. He was urging us to get interested in some of these things, you know, to preserve holy places and all that. So, yes. So I think I'll leave it there. And thank you very much for listening. All glories to Srila Prabhupada.
Jaya, all glories to Srila Prabhupada. I don't have a question or a comment. Anybody else?
All right.
Other than when I was in Philadelphia once visiting, Ravindra Sharup gave it was the best lecture I ever heard on Omkara. Happened to be in a verse in Srimad Bhagavatam, I think 6th canto or something like that. Anyway, that was a relationship to the verse in the purport. It was talking about Omkara. And the a number of meanings that are given to the Omkara throughout Srila Prabhupada's purports in various sections of the Bhagavatam of the Chaitanya Charitamrita are actually amazing. There's about 5 different meanings that he could enumerate. There's, of course, in the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna goes over each letter, what the meaning is. And then he pointed out that one meaning is, we have one letter means the living entities, another letter means the material energy, and another letter means the spiritual energy. And then another meaning was that one is Radha, and one is Krishna, and one is all the other living entities. And then another meaning was it's the entire universe within the Omkara. And I can't remember the others, but it was absolutely astonishing. You know, how much is there within the vibration of Om.
Yes.
But I appreciate very much the way you gave the class, you know, pointing out that this verse signifies Krishna, how you can see him in the various material elements, you know, beginning from fire, water, air, ether. I was thinking of Lydian man, that more has to do with a mode of being. But anyway, at least the Panchabhuta are there in that verse. So anyway, that was good.
Thank you. So this thing you said about Om, where did you say it came from again?
There was a lecture that Ravindra Sharup gave when I was visiting Philadelphia, and it was absolutely amazing how many meanings there that Prabhupada describes in different ways what the Omkara means.
Yes. Yeah.
If I can ever find a copy of that lecture, I'll like to share it with others. It was really good.
I think that would be much appreciated. It sounds like something quite wonderful. So we'd like to, if you do find it, yes, I'd like to know about it.
Hare Krishna, Rishabh
Prabhu. Hare Krishna.
Thank you very much for a nice class. I also wanted just maybe a little comment to give on Prabhupada's purport. It's really nicely describing how there is no contradiction between impersonalism and personalism in our philosophy. And I was thinking when the impersonalists, it's very difficult actually, they see big contradiction. It looks to me like it would be easier for us to preach because we preaching both simultaneously, impersonalism and personalism. Could you a bit comment on that?
Yes, because I mean, for us, the common sense situation of about personalism is that everyone can actually understand, like Krishna says in the 12th chapter, that for those who worship the impersonal aspect, you know, to make advancement is very difficult because we just cannot relate to it. Ultimately, we cannot relate to the impersonal. It's very difficult to love, to have a conception of loving something that is impersonal. And we can all see that we have relationships here. If we explain to people that everything in this material world is a shadow of something that actually exists in reality, they actually begin to understand that, yes, I can see that there are relationships here. There's brother and sister, there's father and mother, there's husband and wife. All these relationships are shadow reflections of something that actually exists in nature and in the spiritual world. And when we see that, the whole of everything that we've seen is like that, has its origin somewhere. And that origin is in Krishna. And it becomes very easy for people to understand a little bit more about how that person ultimately is a personal, that personal conception becomes much easier to understand, because everybody also understands that we are looking for love in this world. Somehow or other, even though we are all thinking our bodies and all that, we actually understand that we have emotions that are going somehow beyond just the bodily concept. And then we can understand that there is spirit, there's spiritual exchanges as well. It's quite easy to understand that there are spiritual exchanges, you know, for people. I think they accept that. They can understand that easier. So the whole idea of personalism is so much more understandable to us than impersonalism. And I'm sure that many people, when they become personalists, they actually see the very logical position of a personalist understanding. You know, I don't know if I'm addressing the particular point that you're making, but I just understand that personalism is just it's very easy for everyone to understand and identify with, you know, as opposed to an impersonal conception. So everything else that we are seeing around us, I mean, when people think it's impersonal, they can't actually understand the origin very well. The origin of anything that we are seeing here, if you say it's impersonal, it's very difficult to see where it's come from, because, like I said about the model that Newton made, everybody can actually understand that ultimately somebody is making something, some intelligence or some personality is making everything that we are seeing. So it's much easier for them to understand, you know, it's much easier to understand that position, that there's somebody who is a supreme person, a supreme intelligence, just like we are seeing intelligence here. There's a supreme intelligence who is doing all these things. Mm-hmm. So from that point of view, personalism, I think, is much more appealing, you know, ultimately to people's understanding and intelligence.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yeah, thank you. Thanks.
Yeah. Hare Krishna. So I guess Amananda Prabhu, that's our session.
Okay. Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Prabhu.
All glory to Srila Prabhupada.
All glory to Srila Prabhupada.
Jai.
Hare Bol.
Jai.
Hare Bol.